This podcast is a ministry of Emmaus, a Jesus church, with Pastor Dominic Doan. For more information, visit us at emmausrdu.com.
So, it was about 3 years ago when a guy by the name of Hubert Dreyfus, who is a philosophy professor at UC Berkeley, not a believer, by the way, but he wrote this fascinating book that maybe some of you have read called All Things Shining. And for a time, it was pretty popular in our nation, topping some charts. But essentially, the essence of the book is he's making this argument that as a culture, we have collectively forgotten how to think about the deeper questions of life. Whether it's questions of meaning or purpose or philosophy, he argues those things have kind of been swept away. And now we live in this culture that has become, for all intents and purposes, culturally, intellectually, societally flat and stale. We live in a culture now that it seems people are more fascinated with checking their Facebook status than it is about wrestling with deeper issues or seeing the next movie or uber distracted on our iPhones. And as a result, we no longer know how to engage with things of value. In fact, in one point in this book, he has a quote by this poet, this other literary genius, a guy by the name of David Foster Wallace. And this is what he said: the central challenge of the contemporary world is not just that we don't know how to live meaningful lives, it's that we don't even seem to be able to focus for very long on the question. There's truth to that, right? Like when you look around us and we see the trajectory that our culture is going in, there is this sense that we truly have forgotten what really matters. Now, all that aside, I agree with that assessment. I agree with what Foster Wallace said. I agree with what Dreyfus argues. But I would add this, I think, very, very important caveat, and that is this. That is true if you have a naturalistic worldview. That's true if it's just about materialism and getting caught up in the here and now, if there is no such thing as a life to come, if there is no God, if there is no creator, if there is no meaning, sure, then things get very, very flat indeed. However, if you're a follower of Christ, something happens, because what Jesus does is he removes for us this dull and naturalistic way of seeing the world, and essentially he gives us a whole new set of eyes. He shows us that there is much more to life than just living for ourselves or the lies that our culture tells us. In fact, if I could take it a step further, I would argue that really that is the essence of this concept of resurrection. The resurrection of Jesus Christ, at its core, is this forceful intrusion into the flatness of our world. Easter, by its very nature, it's not just some annual holiday that Christians celebrate. Sure, it is that, but more than that, Easter disrupts the superficial. It has a way of invading the shallow, and it presents us with a more compelling, even mountainous way of viewing this world. And then Easter invites us to step into that reality. Now, I share all that stuff because as we get here into Mark chapter 16, at its core, I think that's what's happening to the women in our story. We have a group of people who initially are kind of living in flatland. They have no hope of resurrection. They have no hope of miracle. They come to a tomb with their hearts heavy and discouraged and depressed because in their limited perspective, that life of Jesus was all that there was. But what we're going to see unfold as we go through these verses is that Jesus, he completely shatters their expectations. They came to the tomb expecting the typical death narrative, but instead what they find is that the tomb is empty and Jesus gives them a whole new vision of reality. It's beautiful what happens and the journey that he takes us on. So let's dive in, if you have your Bibles open, beginning in verse 1. The resurrection story begins early in the morning. It says, when Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Interesting. So our story begins. Mary and her friends, they're the first ones at the tomb. In fact, the other gospels, they would say, not only that, they're the first ones to see the resurrected Jesus, and they're the first ones who would share of this message. Matthew tells us that when they come to the tomb, they're grieving, they're broken, Mary is crying. Again, it's flatland, right? There's no hope of resurrection. And our text tells us that they came to anoint Jesus' body. Now, this was a very, very common practice in the ancient world. Back then, when you had the death of someone significant, and if you had the resources to pull it off, what you would do is you would take these spices, you'd mix together myrrh and aloe in some cases, and you would blend it into this oil, which you would then pour upon the dead body, or you'd rub it into the skin. And this was a way, first of all, A, showing your affection and love and commitment to the person. But secondly, this was a way of preserving the body. I mean, this is the day before CSI and formaldehyde, and they understood that 2-3 days down the road, the body's going to begin to decompose and rot. So it was a very practical way of offsetting this inevitable stench that would happen. So they come to the tomb to anoint Jesus. One of the things I think we need to note here that here in the West, we can easily skip over. But if we were living in the first century, this would have been shocking, even scandalous, is that Mark mentions that the very first people at the tomb, the very first witnesses of the resurrection, the other gospels, the first people who would spread the good news about the resurrection, were, in fact, women. Now we think, big deal, so what, right? We hardly even notice this. But back then, this was a big deal. Because if you've studied Greco-Roman culture, you know that women during those days held a very low place in the societal ladder, right? They had very few rights. They weren't allowed to own property. In fact, in those days, in Greek culture, women were seen as the property of men. Their testimony meant absolutely nothing in the court of law. Now, what's the point here? Here's the point. A few years later, a guy by the name of Celsus comes on the scene. Celsus is a Greek philosopher. He lived some 80 years after Jesus. And he writes this book. Here's a picture of him from Paris. You can go see it in the Louvre. And Celsus, he argues, look, we cannot trust this thing called Christianity. And the reason why we can't trust it is because the whole premise is built upon resurrection. And we know that the first witnesses of resurrection, those testifying of the resurrection, were women. And Celsus writes in his brutal book, where he's challenging Christianity, he says, and we all know that we can't trust women, right? Women, they're all over the map, they're up and down, we can't trust their testimony. So why should we trust that Jesus has risen from the dead? Why should we trust what the gospel narratives are telling us? Now, Celsus chauvinism aside, and that's another subject, what is intriguing to me, what's so fascinating to me, is that if Mark were making this up, if this were just a fabrication, if this is just a story he's inventing, there is no way that he would insert women in this story. This was the cultural equivalent of shooting yourself in the foot. Like if he's trying to gain credibility, win people over to his perspective, in that culture, he would say, it was a group of guys, furthermore, educated, wealthy guys, they were the ones who saw the resurrected Jesus. But instead, he says that it was women who saw Jesus. The only possible reason to put women in these accounts is if they actually saw Jesus. And the only way we can explain them being depicted as the first eyewitnesses of the empty tomb is if they were the first eyewitnesses of the empty tomb. In other words, there's no way that this can be legend or fairy tale. There is no way that Mark could be simply inventing this to gain followers. What Mark is doing here is recording history. And as he's recording it, he says, it was women who came. Mary, the other Mary, and Salome. They're the ones who first encounter the resurrected Lord. Now, keep going. Verse 2. It says, very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb, and they asked each other, who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb? But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. So they're walking to the tomb. They're having this conversation among themselves. Okay, we need to go anoint Jesus. We have these oils. And as they're approaching the tomb, all of a sudden it dawns on them, wait a minute, how are we going to get in? Right? This is a slight detail that they had overlooked, maybe in their grief or maybe their excitement to anoint Jesus. They had totally forgotten the fact that physically it was impossible to gain entrance to that tomb. Why? Because in the ancient world, tombs were typically carved into the side of hills or mountains. They would then take a massive stone, a boulder, that in some cases was 6 or 7 feet wide, 2 or 3 feet thick. It's hundreds, if not thousands, of pounds that would take a group of guys to roll it over to effectively seal that tomb and prevent grave robbers from coming in and stealing the contents that were inside. So they're walking to the tomb, and one of them says, oh, we forgot this, right? How's this going to work? We're not strong enough, right? We haven't done Pilates for a couple weeks. How's this going to work? So they're having this whole conversation. But then in verse 4, the very thing that they were so worried about, the very thing they were so stressed about, how's this going to work? How will the stone roll away? They get there and they discover that the stone was already rolled away. Now, there's a lot that we could say here, but let me just put this out for our consideration. What this tells us, the fact that the stone was rolled away at the time of Jesus' resurrection, is a strong clue. It's a signpost pointing in the direction that Jesus' resurrection was not simply a metaphorical or a symbolic or quote-unquote spiritual event. This was the kind of event that actually moved boulders, right? There's a sense of physicality to the text. There's a sense that this was so powerful that even a 1,000-pound stone couldn't stand in the way of this Jesus. Now, I mention this because it is somewhat vogue among scholarship today. I think of Bart Ehrman, who's over in Chapel Hill, or John Crossan, who is a very liberal biblical theologian. They would argue that the resurrection was just a spiritual thing. It was just metaphorical. Jesus didn't actually rise from the dead. Now, this is something that just lived in their hearts. It's an allegory or a story of hope. It's wishful thinking. But that's not what Mark records for us. Everything about this text is literal, that there's an earthiness, a rawness, an authenticity to it. And furthermore, when you look at the disciples, you find that they are so impacted and inspired by the resurrected Jesus that they would actually go and die for this fact. Now, I don't know too many people who would die for a metaphor, right? Jesus is metaphorically alive. Kill me. I'll die for that. Like, really? No, they're dying for a Jesus whom they saw, whom they touched, whom they experienced. The stone is rolled away. The only way to account for their sacrifice is if something literal and historical actually took place. So here come the women. They're brokenhearted. They're carrying these oils and spices to anoint the dead corpse of Jesus. They're worried about the stone, but the stone was rolled away. Now keep reading verse 5. It says, as they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. Don't be alarmed, he said. You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. Now, when they arrive, again, their expectations, kind of this flat land, a limited perspective, a limited worldview, they're coming to see a corpse. They're coming to see the dead body of Jesus. But instead, when they arrive, they enter into the tomb, and there's an angel who's sitting there. And the angel pronounces this news. He says, he's not here. He's risen, just like he said. Now, we see their reaction in verse 5. It says, when they saw this, they were alarmed. In the Greek, it's actually a pretty strong word. It's the word ekthambeo. And it's a word that speaks of not just, oh, wow, we're shocked, but it speaks of terror, shock, and even panic. The idea here is that they're almost passing out. This is an experience that is so intense, something they had never ever seen before. Now, this tells us a couple things. One, there's something about angels that inspires panic, right? When you look in the scripture, every time an angel shows up, the natural result is people fall on their face and they're freaking out. And angels always then say, like this one does, hey, don't be afraid. It's like something they learned in Angel School 101, right? Always lead with this. They're going to freak out, but you say, don't be afraid. So there's something about just seeing this angel that's terrifying them. But secondly, what this tells me, and I think more importantly, they weren't expecting this. This was the last thing on their radar. They had come for an empty, they had come not for an empty tomb, but for a dead corpse. Just the fact that they're wanting to anoint Jesus' body tells us that their worldview is limited, opaque, and flat. But what is so fascinating to me, and this is what hit me this last week. Okay, they're shocked by this. They almost can't believe it. Wow, he's risen? Really? Well, didn't Jesus tell you that he would rise again from the dead? In fact, when you look at the Gospels, you find that's exactly what happened. Over and over again, Jesus told them this exact thing. If you'd like to take notes, a few verses. This is just from Matthew, a handful. Matthew 16, verse 21. Matthew 17, 23. Matthew 20, verse 19. I will die and rise again. Hey, I will die and rise again. Hey, guys, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to die, and then I'm going to rise again from the dead. Now, Jesus couldn't have made it any more clear. So what's going on here? Why are they so surprised by this thing that Jesus told them over and over and over again would happen? I was wrestling with this last week, and honestly, I think what it boils down to is they didn't understand. Even when Jesus is telling them this, they didn't have a frame of reference, whether it's theological or philosophical or historical or even cultural. They're living in a day and age where the concept of resurrection was a foreign concept. The Greeks, we know, in the first century, they flat out didn't believe in resurrection. The Epicureans, they had a huge influence back then. Eat, drink, and be merry. Tomorrow we die, right? This life is all that you have. The Jews, on the other hand, they had an underdeveloped view of resurrection. Sure, they thought it would happen someday, but in their perspective, it would be a mass event. It wasn't going to be just one person singularly rising from the dead. So when you put yourself in that perspective, you can understand, oh, they didn't have boxes to put this in, right? They're hearing Jesus say this, but it's almost like Jesus is speaking a different kind of language. This was something far more extreme and wonderful than they dared to hope or even imagine. Now, if you've done much traveling, you know that things don't always translate well from language to language. And sometimes we can put our foot in our mouth when we're trying to explain things. As many of you know, I used to be a missionary in a place called Vanuatu, which is out in the South Pacific, kind of near Fiji, New Caledonia, Solomon Islands. And I was there in my early 20s for about 3 years. And the job that we had was to teach through the Bible from Genesis to Revelation to a group of students that came all around from these surrounding islands to this little school that we had and to learn, to study, to grow. and then to be sent out to start churches or schools or what have you. And so I'm there in my early 20s, show up, and honestly, when I first got there, I'm a little afraid because I'd heard rumors about cannibalism, and it's a totally new concept and culture for me, and a new language which I had to learn. They speak this language called Bislama, and best way I know how to describe Bislama is that it's a cross between caveman meets pig Latin meets Tarzan, right? You just kind of combine it all together. That's Bislama. Like the word slingshot, which they use to catch their food, you would say, "Hit me one elastic blong shoot'em pigeon." Or the word piano, probably my favorite word there. You wouldn't just say piano, you would say, "Hit me one big fella box," where he got white teeth blong him, mo he got black teeth blong him, mo suppose you kill him teeth blong him me sing out long you. That's piano. Now you can imagine my angst when I have to teach on the word justification. Like that took 3 months just for that word, right? So we're sitting around the fire one night and we're talking, having a good time. And one of the guys, he says, "Now Dominic, can you tell us a story about America?" Now you have to keep in mind that it's essentially the Stone Age there. Most of the people, they didn't even know there was such a place as America. Like, their world was their island. There's no electricity, no running water, no internet, none of that. So, like, okay, tell us a story about this land where you come from. And so I thought about it. Okay, what would be cool to tell them about? What's a neat place in America? And then I thought, oh, you know what? I'm going to tell them about Disneyland. No sooner did I say those words, I immediately, like, grab them back. Like, there's no way on earth to describe it. So if you're trying to describe Disneyland to someone who's never ever heard of it or ever been there, who's living in the Stone Age, where do you start? So I thought, well, let's just start with Mickey Mouse, right? That makes the most sense. The problem is there's no word for mouse in their language. The closest they have is big fella rat. So I say, okay, check this out. There's this place and there's a big fella rat. And they're like, "How big?" I'm like, 8 foot tall, 10 foot tall. Now this is like their worst nightmare, right? Rats are a huge problem in Vanuatu. And so I'm like, well, it's not like it's a real rat. There's actually a person inside the rat. Like, so he eats people then. Oh no, he doesn't eat people, but he can talk and stuff. Like, what? You know, what is this, right? So like, okay, let's move on from the rat till, okay, there's this big fella rat, but he lives inside this palace, but there's no word for palace. The closest they had is big fella hut. So there's a big, big fella hut. And I'm trying to describe, okay, there's lights, and it's beautiful, it's colorful. And they're just looking at me. There's no electricity. Like, they have no clue what I'm talking about. So here's this 8 foot tall talking rat that somehow has a person inside of him that they're trying to believe me that he's a benevolent, kind rat, but they're not sure about that. And so he lives inside of this place. So they're so confused. I'm like, okay, forget the rat. Forget the hut. There's rides there. There's these teacups, but there's no word for teacup. So the closest is big fella cup, right? So these big fella cup, and you sit inside the big fella cup, and it spins you around and around, and they're just looking at me stone quiet. And finally, one of the guys, he's like, "Dominic," he's totally serious, "you should never, ever go to Disneyland." I say, "Why not?" He says, "It is an evil place." And that rat you're describing, he's a witch doctor. Don't trust him. Now, he might be true about the rat. Like, I've always had my questions about Mickey Mouse. But the fact of the matter is, like, I'm trying to describe this place that is so much more beautiful. It's a whole nother dimension, right? It's something that they have no way of trying to understand. I would argue, in a sense, that that's what's happening here. That Jesus, as he's talking about resurrection and he's laying out for them the life to come and the kingdom and all of these things, he's describing it in language that he could grasp and trying to make it something that they could understand. But in reality, all these women heard was big fella hut, big fella rat. Like, okay, we don't get this. That's why they're so afraid. That's why we see in these resurrection stories, they come, they experience the resurrection, and they're shocked, they're in awe, they're petrified, they're terrified, they don't know what to do with it. Now, verse 7, it says this, "But go, tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee, and there you will see him just as he told you." Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and they fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. Now, we know from other gospels that they continued to be afraid, but later on they would share this good news. They would tell the guys, "Hey, check this out. Come to the tomb, see for yourself that he is risen." Now, the story ends. The women, they've come expecting a corpse, instead an angel, an empty tomb, and then the angel dispatches them. He sends them out. He says, "Go. Okay, you've seen the resurrection. You've seen that the tomb is empty. Now you have a task. Go and tell the disciples and tell Peter that he is risen from the dead." Couple thoughts and we're done today. The first thing that I absolutely love about how Mark closes this resurrection story is that he is telling us through the message of this angel that the resurrection has implications. That this good news that Jesus has risen from the dead isn't just something for us to sit on or think about or say, that's interesting or curious. I think I'll write it down in my journal. I'll sing songs about it. Maybe I'll underline it in my Bible. No, the fact that they're sending out the women tells us that we are to do something with this news. They were brought to the tomb, not just so that they could feel warm inside, not just so that they could have a nice private encounter with this angel. The whole point of it was to mobilize them to be ambassadors of the good news, to go out and to share with others the reality of this risen Lord. You see, brothers and sisters, when the resurrection begins to sink down in our hearts, when we understand that it's more than just some metaphorical thing or a story of 2,000 years ago, that changes the way we do everything. In fact, I would argue when you look at the book of Acts, it's the resurrection that is motivating and pushing the church forward. Every sermon in the book of Acts comes back to the resurrection. The resurrection is central to their message. 12 of the 28 chapters in Acts talks about the resurrected Lord. They started meeting on Sunday in honor of the resurrection. They baptized people because that was a physical reminder and expression of the resurrection of Jesus. For the early church, for these women, the resurrected story wasn't just a story, metaphor, allegory. It was something that inspired them to do something and to tell the world of this good news. The same thing is true of us. The resurrection has implications. The resurrection affects everything. It's like the story of the guy who was in Israel and he's going on one of those, Israel tours, and great time. He's there with his mother-in-law, in fact. And as they're walking around seeing the Holy Land, his mother-in-law tragically, suddenly died. And so he's trying to figure out what to do. Like, do I bury her here in the land? And he found out it was about $500 to do that. Or do I put her on a plane, take her back home, and bury her there? But he found out it was $20,000 to do that. So he thought about it for a little bit, and he decided, you know what? I'm going to take her home. I'm going to bury her there. One of his friends comes up to him, and he's like, "Wow, that's really touching that you would do that. Like, you must really care for your mother-in-law, that you're willing to spend all that money to put her on a plane, to send her back to the States." And he stopped him. He's like, "Well, it's not that so much." He said, "In reality, when I was here in Israel, I heard this story about a guy who was buried here and 3 days later rose again from the dead. I can't afford to take that risk," right? You see, for him, resurrection meant something. And for us, if Jesus is risen, well, doesn't that have implications for how you're going to live your life? Doesn't that have implications for how you raise your kids or treat your spouse or manage your finances or what you look at online or the decisions you make or the trajectory of your life or who you date? Resurrection affects everything. Go, tell the disciples, go, tell the world, be an ambassador, be a mouthpiece of this good news. God has shown you the empty tomb, not just for you to sit, but rather for you to go. Now, the next thing that I notice here, and we'll close on this, is that not only do we see the implications of resurrection, but I love that the angels specifically mention Peter. Again, look back in our story. In verse 7, go tell his disciples and Peter that he is going ahead of you into Galilee. You know, for years, I've read this and I've studied this. In fact, I taught on this when I was a pastor in Maui, but I've never until this last week really noticed that the angels specifically say, oh, and tell Peter. I've been wrestling with this. Why? Well, why don't they say, go and tell Matthew? Go and tell Luke. Go and tell James. Why do they specifically single out Peter of all the disciples? Why instead not just a generic term? Just tell all the guys about him. Here's why. It hit me. I wonder if the angels are specifically mentioning Peter because Peter, of all the people, needed to hear this word of hope. For the answer, we see, in fact, two passages, John 18 and John 21, we see why. John 18, Jesus was arrested, he's betrayed, he's led away to be crucified, and Peter is following Jesus at a distance, always a dangerous thing to do, right? He ends up at the enemy's fire, a servant girl comes up to him, hey, you were with Jesus, weren't you? He's like, nope. Yeah, you were, right? Your speech betrays you. No, I wasn't. Three times Peter denies Jesus. And just like Jesus had predicted, the rooster crowed. And the weight of what Peter did came crashing down upon him. And the Gospels tell us that Peter did what? Wept. And not just wept, but he wept bitterly. It's this sense of raw, visceral, uncontrollable sobbing. This man is so discouraged and so disheartened by what he had done. He's sobbing, weeping. I can't believe that I betrayed Jesus. In fact, he's so discouraged. Check out John 21. What does he do? He goes back to his old life of fishing, right? What he used to do before he followed Jesus. And it's there on the same lake where he was first called that Peter goes back and he's fishing all night and catches nothing. Jesus comes to him and he stands on the shore and he calls out to him and says, friends, have you caught anything? That's always surprised me. If I were Jesus and someone had just betrayed me, I'd be like, losers, have you caught anything? Ex-disciples, right? But he says, friends. He's like, no, I haven't, which some say is the first miracle after the resurrection, a fisherman telling the truth, right? I haven't caught anything. And Jesus says, throw your nets on the other side. He obeys, and what happens? He catches dozens and dozens of fish. And in that moment, Peter realized it is the Lord. What did he do? It says that Peter put on his coat, jumped into the water, and swam for shore. Now that's surprising too, isn't it? Like if you're about to go for a swim in a lake, you're usually taking clothes off, right? He's putting clothes on. He puts on his jacket. Why? I think that's Peter's way of saying, you know what? I'm done with this boat. I'm done with this old way of living. I'm done with not following Jesus. I'm taking my stuff. I'm going for it. I'm jumping in. I'm going to serve him and follow him. And he swims to shore, soaking wet. And Jesus begins to minister to him and says, Peter, feed my sheep. Peter, I am reinstating you. I'm calling you back as my disciple. Now go and be an ambassador of this good news. You see, brothers and sisters, that is the God that we serve. We serve a God who takes a broken, burnt out, backslidden Peter and gives him another chance. We serve the kind of God who takes women who are discouraged and heavy-hearted and have a limited view of reality, and he gives them a message to share with the world. We serve a God who takes men and women like us with our flaws and issues and brokenness and wounds, and he says, come and follow me. The message of Easter is not so much for people who think they have it all together. The message of Easter is for the hurting, the diseased, the broken, the worried, the insecure, the backslidden, those struggling, those addicted, those wrestling, those doubting. Those are the people that are invited into his grace. And it could very well be today, right now, that there are some Peters in our midst. Maybe this is your story. You are right now in need of grace. You have spent time at the enemy's fire. You've made some decisions. You've gone in certain directions. You've done things that you now regret. And you've come here today maybe with a perspective like Peter had. You know what? God's probably through with me. He set me on the back burner. He's angry, right? I heard a guy tell me a few weeks ago, he said, there's no way I'm coming to church. I'm like, why not? He's like, if I come to church, lightning's gonna hit that building, right? And so many people have that view of God. He's angry, he's a tyrant, he's given up on us. And maybe you today have walked into this place carrying that same sense of guilt and failure and discouragement, or maybe like these women, you've had a flatland view of reality, you've been caught up in your own little world, or you've just been focused on the here and now, and you failed to see that God is doing something much bigger and more beautiful, and he's inviting you to be a part of that story. Wherever you're at today, the resurrected Jesus invites you into his love. The beautiful thing about resurrection is that it means that the past doesn't control you. What you did last week or yesterday or 10 years ago, those things no longer have dominion over you. It has been crucified with Christ. It is in the past. It's forgotten. The Bible says the old things have passed away. All things have become new. David says he's taken our sin and he's cast it as far as the east is from the west. And today you can experience that new life that Jesus has for you. What does that look like? Simply this: come. Religion gives us another narrative. Religion says, oh, okay, you want to be changed? Then follow these rules and keep these laws, and read more, and study more, and do more, right? And once you've done all these things, then you will be accepted. But Christianity and Jesus says, you come as you are. Come when you're weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Are there any today where you know it's time for you to come? It's time right now to abandon the boat and jump headlong into the water. What boat, what nets, what fish is Jesus calling you to leave behind today and to serve him and follow him and know him? Now, speaking of water and lakes, we have a mini one right here. And you can come right now and you can surrender yourself to Jesus. An outward display of this beautiful truth of what Jesus has done for you. You might say, well, Pastor Dom, I didn't bring any clothes with me. Well, neither did Peter, right? He went in his coat, right? You come as you are. Maybe you weren't planning on this. Maybe it wasn't something that you thought you were gonna do this morning. But listen, the Bible says today is the day of salvation. Not tomorrow. Tomorrow's not guaranteed you. Right here, right now, this is your moment on this Easter Sunday to say, you know what? I'm sick of living for myself. I'm sick of these sins. I'm sick of this discouragement. I'm sick of this heaviness. I'm sick of this guilt, this past that's trying to swallow me up. Today, I want to be set free from that, and I want the slate to be wiped clean, and I'm going to serve Jesus and follow Jesus and follow hard after Jesus. I'm jumping into the lake no matter what it means, no matter what it looks like, no matter what other people think of me. It's time for me to have a new life right here, right now. You can be resurrected. Let's stand and let's pray, shall we? Father, I pray in the name of